Seneca 18, AD 55, Slaughter and Mercy. Hi everyone, and welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. In the last podcast, we took a look at the events of the first part of AD 55. The Senate at that time was happy to sit on the fence and await the outcome of the power struggle playing out between Agrippina on the one hand and Seneca and Burrus on the other for control of the 17-year-old Emperor Nero. Now, by the end of that podcast, we'd learned that Seneca and Burrus had come out on top, and a vengeful Agrippina had transferred her support to her stepson Britannicus, who was fast approaching his 14th birthday, a significant step towards manhood in the Roman tradition, and had therefore become a viable political pawn. And Nero, while all this jockeying for power and influence was going on, was hatching his own plans. We heard how he was beginning to chafe under so much interference in his life and personal ambition, and also that he was very aware that his stepbrother, Britannicus, still excited sympathy among many of the Roman elite. It was still widely felt that Britannicus had been robbed of his birthright after the death of his father, Claudius, the ex-emperor, around whose death rumours of murder and foul play at the hands of Agrippina continued to circulate. And for that reason alone, as far as Nero was concerned, Britannicus was a threat, and he simply had to go. On the 11th of February, AD 55, very pointedly, a day before his 14th birthday and the donning of the toga virilis, or the toga of manhood, Britannicus died. Just like Claudius before him, Britannicus's death occurred at a banquet, and again, just like Claudius before him, it happened under extremely suspicious circumstances. But before I report what the ancient commentators had to say about this latest incident at the palace, it's worth bearing in mind that in historical terms, we're talking a bare 4 months since the death, many still thought murder, of the boy's father. In that context, that is, with rumours that Claudius had been murdered still very much alive in the popular mind, any foul play would have been an incredibly risky gambit. To my way of thinking, for Nero to have even entertained the possibility that he could get away with knocking off Britannicus so soon after the poisoning of Claudius, he must have been very, very confident that his political spin doctor, Lucius Annaeus Seneca, would be able to pull off a major propaganda coup to take the heat out of any public backlash, just as Seneca had managed to do with his apocolicentosis to justify Nero's succession a mere couple of months before. And, as things turned out, Nero's confidence in his tutor-turned-advisor's ability to spin events to his pupil's advantage would prove to be very well-founded indeed. Before we get to Seneca's extraordinary publicity campaign to justify Britannicus's death, though, let's hear what the ancient commentators had to say about the night Britannicus met his fate. Now, according to Tacitus, Nero enlisted the skills of the notorious Locusta, the same woman who had reportedly played a part in the poisoning of Claudius. And the parallels with the reports of Claudius's poisoning don't end there. Just like the incident with his father 4 months previously, Britannicus's attendants were turned against him. The poison was first administered by his tutors, but, and again in a rerun of Claudius's demise, the first draft didn't do the trick, so Locusta had to rebrew on the fly. The second draft was snuck into some cold water that was to be added to a beaker of liquid that was initially too hot and which a taster had already safely okayed Britannicus to drink. This time, the boy perished almost straight away. And although Britannicus died in front of everyone present, Nero tried to allay immediate suspicion by announcing that his stepbrother was suffering an epileptic fit, something Britannicus had suffered from since birth, apparently, and that, if left alone, Britannicus would soon recover. Cassius Dio, another commentator, agrees that Nero murdered Britannicus by means of poison, but he then adds extra detail and claims that Nero later smeared the boy's skin with gypsum to conceal the telltale lividness left by the action of the poisoned draught. And that detail was backed up, or possibly copied, by the often sensational commentator Suetonius. Josephus Flavius, yet another commentator, is far less verbose than the others, stating simply that Nero poisoned Britannicus and concealed it from the public. So was Britannicus poisoned, or did he die of natural causes? Well, again, like the circumstances surrounding the death of Claudius, it's what happened immediately after the boy's death which gives us the best idea. Tacitus tells us that there were signs Britannicus's funeral had been pre-arranged. It occurred on the very night of his death. Now, nighttime funerals were a feature of childhood death in ancient Rome. The literature is actually full of accounts of eerie, torch-lit funeral corteges. And Britannicus's funeral consisted of an apparently inexpensive and rushed cremation held on the Campus Martius. The gypsum with which the boy's body had been plastered to conceal the effects on the skin of the poison is said to have washed off in a sudden downpour, a sign of the god's displeasure, according to some, and it revealed the crime to the crowd that had assembled there. And how did Nero explain the lack of a state funeral for somebody of such elevated birth? Well, he simply cited the fact that Britannicus had still been a minor at the time of his death, albeit by a single day, and as such was not entitled to one. Moreover, Nero is said to have been actively encouraging Britannicus's licentious behaviour in the period leading up to his death, so that public sympathy might not be so intense. And what's more, in an attempt to avoid any further scrutiny into the incident from members of his own class, Nero bought off any potential antipathy with a massive handout of property and wealth. And that property and wealth went especially to his friends, who undoubtedly included Seneca himself. Now, all of those reports of the ancient commentators is pretty much hearsay. I mean, they're reports by men who were writing at least one generation, often more, after the events on which they were reporting. For me, though, far more telling than the accounts of the ancient commentators, many or all of whom had, as I have often mentioned during this podcast series, their own personal or political axes to grind. Yes, more important for me is what Lucius Annaeus Seneca did next. There's no doubt that, in the wake of Britannicus's death, whether Seneca had been complicit in it or not, he'd have had to shift into massive damage control mode. Now, Nero may have been putting it about, probably on Seneca's advice, that his stepbrother's death allowed the emperor to now give his sole attention to governing the empire. But Seneca was well aware that that proclamation in itself was never going to be enough to put a lid on the public rumour mill and prevent a backlash. So what Seneca did next was pull off an absolute masterstroke. He authored a work entitled De Clementia, or On Clemency or Mercy, and it remains, even today, one of the most extraordinary works of political manipulation ever written. It was so groundbreaking, so breathtakingly ambitious in its intent, that Machiavelli, writing a good millennium and a half later, saw fit to describe it as a major influence behind his own seminal political masterpiece, The Prince. Before I get into what Seneca was attempting to do, though, it's important to remember that right from the beginning of Nero's principate, Seneca had been the emperor's ghostwriter. Every edict, every speech before the Senate, every funeral oration even, that came out of Nero's mouth originated in Seneca's stylus. So it was no wonder that the elder Pliny, a contemporary of the events I'm describing, wrote of Seneca that he was principatum eruditorum ac potentia, the chief at that time among learned men and the most powerful. The early months of Nero's reign had started with proclamations of clemency and conciliation, which was no doubt down to Seneca advising his young charge to start his rule by distancing his policies from those of his immediate predecessors. Even the Apocolicintosis, a literary exercise to legitimise the accession of Nero, had followed that pattern, with Nero's reign heralding a new golden age that would be the true successor to that of the great Augustus. But the murder of Britannicus, coming when it did, had rather blotted that particular copybook. So Seneca, with his De Clementia, had to take the Nero as Augustus propaganda to a whole new level. In the way he managed to achieve that leaves me lost in admiration. De Clementia was addressed to Nero himself. The work has come down to us in truncated form. It finishes halfway through chapter 7 of book 2, but what survives is still quite substantial, and it's more than enough to identify what Seneca is up to. If we recall from a previous podcast, in the Consolatio ad Polybium, written by Seneca from exile approximately a decade earlier and addressed to the Emperor Claudius, Seneca had attempted a form of remote psychoengineering. In that work, he'd attempted to put words into the emperor's mouth and, by depicting Claudius as a magnanimous, forgiving conqueror, had hoped to make him behave accordingly and recall Seneca from exile. Now that attempt had failed miserably, but Seneca was now in a far more elevated and powerful position, and he was ready to repeat the trick. Back in AD 44, he'd been up against a man he barely knew, a man, moreover, influenced by a wife, Messalina, who absolutely hated Seneca. But now, this time round, he was dealing with a 17-year-old youth, somebody whose mind he had been guiding and moulding for the previous 6 or 7 years, or so he thought. And this time, Seneca was going to attempt something far more ambitious. He was going to try to manipulate the very behaviour of the ruler of the Roman world. Because Seneca had learned from a very early age to keep his head below the political parapet, there is very little outside reference to contemporary events in his works, something that's led to a lot of confusion and debate about when some of the works were written. Now, luckily for us, in De Clementia, there is a comparison of Nero's age with that of Augustus at a similar one. The Latin actually reads, Duo de vicensimum egressus annum, that is, having just passed his 18th year of life. And it refers to Augustus. So it's not entirely clear exactly what age Nero was in comparison, although it must have been fairly close. Now, Nero's 18th birthday was in December AD 55. That time frame would have given Seneca ample time to compose De Clementia. Although the Latin could also be taken to mean that Nero had just set out on his 18th year of life, on the same basis that when you pass your first birthday, you are entering your second year of life, meaning that Nero was still only 17. Either way, whether shortly after Britannicus's death or shortly after Nero's 18th birthday, we can safely assume that De Clementia was circulated within a year of the murder. And one last thing before I dive into the work proper is that I want to point out Seneca's use in his prose works of citations and quotations from other authors. Citations can tell you a lot. They can tell you about what's influencing an author and what that author is thinking about at a certain point in their writing. When many citations appear, as they do, for instance, in Seneca's Serenus trilogy, which are essentially works of philosophical purism, I take it that Seneca is drawing on the authority of great names from the past, or attempting to assert his own authority and learning by arguing with and trumping what they'd had to say. So when, conversely, I see very few citations in a book by Seneca, I understand that he wants his voice to be the only voice that he wants his readership to hear. His is the authority that must stand out. And with Seneca, that situation, that is very few citations, tends to happen when there is a high political imperative behind the purpose of the book in question. Now, De Clementia is one such book. Seneca wrote it in an attempt to stabilise an emperor that he was beginning to realise had the potential to go off the rails, and thereby calm the fears of those who saw the murder of Britannicus as the prelude to yet another Julio-Claudian reign of bloodshed and terror. So De Clementia was an attempt to regain control, to persuade the Roman people that getting rid of Britannicus had actually been a good thing. And De Clementia contains only 3 citations, which means that when those citations are used, they are very, very pointed. They are all absolutely loaded with political innuendo, and I'll come to them in a minute. So Seneca starts De Clementia with a direct address to Nero, suggesting that the emperor look into the book's contents as if he's looking into a mirror. The psychology behind this is, of course, to instill a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy into Nero's mind. You know, if you paint a complimentary picture of somebody's attributes, it encourages them to fulfill the expectation they believe others have of them. The Nero of De Clementia is made to assert that he passes judgments that are not based on anger or immature youth, that his sword is not only hidden, but sheathed, and that he shows mercy to those of even the meanest blood. The language is all couched in terms of Stoic philosophy, all designed to illustrate that Nero has fully absorbed the wise teachings of his moral guide, who is none other than Seneca himself. Having set up Nero, then, as the paradigm of princely virtue, Seneca pulls his masterstroke. He draws a direct comparison between Nero and the young Augustus, but this is not the airy-fairy Golden Age propaganda comparison that we read in the Apocolicontosis. No, this is a comparison with the young Octavian, Augustus's original name, who was forced, at a similar age to Nero, to slaughter his way to the top of the pile by butchering his enemies in a massive bloodbath of Roman civil war. For Octavian, that is Augustus, so much bloodletting, says Seneca, was an absolutely necessary prerequisite so that he could establish order and peace as the sole authority in the state, and thereby herald a new era of prosperity to pave the way for the splendour that was to become Imperial Rome. In other words, Seneca is holding up Augustus as a prime, if not the prime, example of a leader for whom slaughtering his way to the top job was not only justifiable, but was even approved by the very gods themselves. It was a brilliant literary ruse that fully absolved Nero, by extension as Augustus's descendant and heir, of any personal or malicious intent in the murder of Britannicus, or indeed Claudius before him. Britannicus's death was not only justifiable, Seneca implies, it was necessary if Rome were to achieve its ultimate God-given destiny. So how do the citations I mentioned earlier come into this? Well, De Clementia, as well as exculpating Nero from any blame in the murder of Britannicus by pitching the deed as a necessary precaution, is also a behavioural blueprint for that philosophical holy grail, the philosopher king. Now Seneca must have realised that Nero might not be as malleable and easily influenced as he'd at first hoped. So he also wrote a veiled warning into the work. I said a short while ago that De Clementia contains only three citations. Well, they are all from non-philosophical sources, and the authors are all Roman. Two of those citations are the same line from Atreus, a play by Accius. That line is the famous "Oderint dum metuant," let them hate so long as they fear. And that quotation was a favourite of the reviled former emperor Caligula, which still, 14 or 15 years after that monster's death, still carried undertones of the political terror of his reign. The third citation is from the revered Roman poet Virgil. It comes from his work entitled The Georgics, and it's a warning about the dire consequences to the hive should the king bee be lost. Now remember, the Romans thought that a king, not a queen bee, ruled a hive, and the Roman ear was very well attuned to the analogy between beehive and state. When lifted from its original context and transposed into a work whose combined intent is to provide a blueprint for the ideal prince and at the same time function as a veiled threat should that prince not meet his moral obligations as head of state, Virgil's line becomes loaded with political innuendo. And so, by authoring De Clementia, a masterclass in face-saving Julio-Claudian propaganda, Seneca was both legitimising Nero's rule beyond any question by justifying the slaying of Britannicus and making an attempt to keep the boy on the straight and narrow. But it was also more evidence of whose side Seneca was on. With its endorsement of Nero as the legitimate successor of the revered Augustus, he was trumping Agrippina's appeal as the daughter of the beloved Germanicus. De Clementia, then, was yet another kick in the teeth for Seneca's erstwhile patroness. And as for Agrippina, well, she now found herself fast running out of options. The murder of Britannicus removed the only piece of any value she had left in the game, although it could well be argued that her siding with the boy had hastened his death. Notwithstanding, she attempted to side with Octavia, Britannicus's sister and Nero's neglected wife, but that too was to prove a dead end. Wanting to put an end to his mother's interference once and for all, Nero, again probably under suggestion from Seneca, dismissed his mother from the imperial palace and moved her into a mansion of her own. To add insult to injury, he also removed her German bodyguard. So it became obvious to everyone in Rome that Agrippina was now a spent force, that Seneca had won the Battle of Wills. Agrippina was slowly deserted, even by those who had once been her friends and allies, and her power and influence slowly ebbed away. There are some reports from the ancient commentators that she attempted to stage another coup with the assistance of Burrus, but nothing ever came of the accusations, and, in any case, Burrus was protected by the now triumphant Seneca, who managed to extricate his friend from any danger of the allegations sticking. Okay, we'll leave it there for the time being. AD 55 ended with Seneca exultant. Agrippina had been reduced to a bit part player in the Julio-Claudian Game of Thrones, and Seneca had the ear of the young Nero exclusively to himself. Or did he? In the next podcast, I'm going to talk about the so-called Quinquennium Neronis, the much-lauded first five golden years of Nero's reign, and I'm going to talk about why, in my opinion, it was no such thing. Because Nero, you see, was beginning already to go off the rails, and Seneca was getting very, very worried. I hope to see you there.